So their body is underground and their train head is up on the tracks. So when you board a train, you're actually standing inside a man's head and he's like running on the ground underneath the train. Hey, everybody. Welcome to episode 129 of Coffee with Butterscotch, the game dev comedy podcast of Butterscotch Shenanigans. I'm Seth and I'm the games programmer.
I'm Adam and I'm the CSS combatter.
I'm Sam and I make words and pictures.
And this is a show where we talk about life, business, and working in the games industry. Today is December 18, 2017.
Still in it.
It keeps hanging in there. Before we get started, we have a warning. Anything could happen on this show. There will be profanity. And also, we're adults, and we're going to talk about adult stuff. Mm-hmm. So this show isn't for kids or babbies. All right. Let's get into the news of the week. For starters, Lootbox Watch 2017. What's the latest in the news?
The latest is that there's a game that came out on Steam called I Can't Believe It's Not Gambling, mm-hmm. which the entire premise of is to strip out all of that stupid stuff that usually happens around you getting loot boxes.
Which is the gameplay.
And you just get loot boxes.
Well, I think you play a really simplified game of Snake.
Correct. But everything you pick up and you eat
is a loot box.
Is a loot box. And then you get to open it afterwards. But my favorite part of it is that most of them are literally piles of trash. So you'll
or trash cans
that have flies on them, and then you can get You can get different loot inside the loot boxes that changes the skins of loot boxes.
Yeah, it's cosmetic changes to your loot boxes. I think you can also get loot boxes that upgrade your future loot boxes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's a great little piece of satire. I think it's like 99 cents. It was on sale for.
I don't know if it's worth playing, but it is worth looking at.
It was 1 cent off at 1%.
Well, I feel like this is sort of it's like the evil twin of mm-hmm. something like Cookie Clicker, right? Mm-hmm. Which is like, so Cookie Clicker, you know, like it uses just the purest form of that craving that people have for growth, mm-hmm. right? And it just like boils it down to its essence, and you just keep clicking on that fucking cookie mm-hmm. for hours and hours and hours for no reason other than that it keeps getting bigger, right? Because like we love that as people. And then if you sort of layer that in with the sort of Pavlovian randomness that comes from loot boxes, and you've got like a random loot box clicker mm-hmm. combo thing, which is weird because like all the reviews on it, people actually have a lot of playtime in this loot box game.
Yeah.
Just because like it actually is full of things that people like.
Ooh, yeah.
Like people love that.
I mean, it works on a psychological
level. Yeah, works on a psychological level. Of course, gameplay wise,
it's not going to win any awards by any stretch.
Yeah.
Except for maybe one for satire. But, and also there was a new regulation came out from, or a new a word from a regulator came out from New Zealand who said that loot boxes are not gambling because you cannot extract real world value back out of the loot box once you put money in, which we were talking a little bit before the podcast started. It sounds like maybe there's just a different definition of gambling on the horizon. So who knows? We'll just keep an eye on it. We'll keep it up to date.
I just can't see a future.
I guess gambling has to be for money, I think, is how it's mostly defined.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I can't see a future in which this doesn't come back to bite all of us in the ass.
Mm-hmm.
Like this skirting, like everybody just like wanting to skirt this line all day long mm-hmm. It's gonna invite way too many questions. I think there's gonna be collateral damage.
We'll see what happens.
We'll see what happens.
Yeah.
So last week we also had a lot of interesting discussions inside the studio about a production process for Scuffle Buddies and also just kind of in general. So let's talk about that. What happened? What's our take?
Well, so the thing kicked it off was I made an art asset and kicked it over to Seth. And that one art asset was essentially trying to solve a problem in the game, but in doing so, of course, ends up creating a need for an additional system or some other programming work to be done. And this happens quite a bit where, because of the sort of fly by the seat of the pants nature of how we make the games, there's frequently times where either I'll make an art asset or Seth will make a new a system that requires sort of retrofitting or doing something to rework some of the art or causes essentially work to get more complicated. And so Seth were kind of arguing about this thing, and Adam heard us and overheard us and came over and was like, it sounds like you guys are just doing this wrong because this shouldn't happen, right?
Yeah.
So essentially what we realized is that we hadn't actually been sitting down a series of rules that we were going to stick by during our our development process such that there was basically a lot of chaos or a lot of randomness that came with us actually doing the dev, which caused blowout in terms of timelines and all this other stuff. And on a smaller game project, that's actually totally fine because there's not enough
things don't have
things, there's not enough room.
When things quote blow out, it's like, oh shit, we got to spend an extra 18 minutes.
Right, right. There's not enough room to worry about it. But on a game like Scuffle Buddies, which has a lot of interacting systems, it kind of got to the point where we're like, oh, okay, if we don't get this under control, then we're going to increase our dev time considerably.
Mm-hmm.
And so we sat down and we said, okay, what have we been doing? What's working about that? What's not working? And then we just kind of hammered it out.
Yeah. So I think for me, the biggest sort of simple way to think about it is that we had put a really strong focus on marketability really early. Cause we're like, we want to get this thing to a state where we can start showing screenshots and start really like promoting it, super early. Which means we kind of treated everything like it needed to be at like final production level. So anytime we created a new art asset, we're like, all right, let's fully animate this thing. Let's get it into its exact state that it needs to be. So it's kind of like that striving for perfection kind of a thing, right? And so that what that means then is that getting things up to that state is just very art and code heavy.
Mm-hmm.
And so every new art asset would take longer than it normally would. And then also that would always add a lot of extra time on the programming side. And because we are sort of iterating on the rules as we go, then a lot of times these art assets would require new rules to be added or new systems to be created, which then either we have to make the decision, do we flesh out the core systems of the game or rework the systems to implement this art asset.
Yeah, you're basically iterating production level code.
Yeah,
right. Which is
just not what you don't, crazy you don't thing do it. Do, yeah. So of course we gotta go back to the sort of focus on the prototype kind of stuff. So our art assets, instead of being, you know, full production level with, you know, broken apart into lots of different pieces and then animated and everything, we just need them to be visually distinctive in the game so that we can test gameplay mechanics and stuff, right? So that means, you know, for maybe a creature, instead of having it be fully colored with five different body parts, we just need a single sprite of that creature.
Mm-hmm.
And we can just move it around in the game world and we'll know what it's doing, right?
Right.
So the focus should be on a lot of these sort of early iterative things. And also the other thing we were doing was anytime we came up with a new idea for a game system that we thought we needed, we would try to future-proof it. Be like, what are all the things that this system would need to do? All right. Let's code all those things up and make it totally generic and robust. But then this early in development, there's a lot of iteration, which means that system might not even be present 2 months from now. So that's just wasted time, right? So this early in dev, you know, the focus should be on just get it in there, get it doing what it needs to do. And then once you really get a sense of the scope and sort of the outline of the problem, then you can make a more generic system that can sort of solve those problems.
Well, like part of it is funny because, of course, this didn't used to be a problem because we didn't have the capacity for this to be a problem because any system we made wasn't generic because we didn't know how to do that in an effective way,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Which meant everything was just very rigidly solved exactly the problem that it was built to solve.
Our problems were actually solved by our own inexperience and stupidity.
Correct.
Much earlier.
Which is a great way to go fast is the thing.
Yeah, when you don't know anything, you don't have any options.
Yeah.
So you're like, all right, so we need to be able to chop trees to get logs out of them. Okay, I'm gonna write up code that literally does exactly that thing. And then when the question comes, well, now we need to chop rocks with a pickaxe. It's like, okay, let me see if I can bend this a little bit, right? And then Crashlands is born eventually, right?
But another part of this that's been interesting is that kind of remembering back during Crashlands dev, which took 2 years. The periods in which it was not a good experience of a game, which is actually most of the dev.
It was about the first 18 months.
Yeah.
At least.
And you would play it and occasionally, you know, we'd have a design pivot or something and get it all worked in and you'd play it and be like, oh yeah, I really see where this is going. But of course it still wasn't good.
Well, you could see where it was going, but it just wasn't getting there.
Yeah.
Like it kept always going toward a good game, but it never quite made it until way, way late.
Yeah. And I think it's been interesting because Adam's been working on this back-end web infrastructure stuff for 6 months now.
About 9 months.
Yeah.
For B-Sketch ID 2. Now Ruckus.
Mm-hmm. And to the point where he was working on it and had to sort of just trust in his ability to pull off the final outcome, but with 9 months of a waiting window before that was actually visible.
Trust in the process and in the end goal. And then you just work.
Yeah. Well, and a lot of it is just these really... complicated problems that have very disappointing outcomes where you're like, we need login. Like, we need a good login mm-hmm. system. And so you spend a lot of time researching and making sure it's really secure and really easy to use. Mm-hmm. A couple months go by, you have login now.
Now you can log in.
Now you can log in.
Cool.
Which is completely useless without other things to do once you have logged in, right?
Yep. So, and so Scuffle Buddies is a more systems-rich game than CrashLens was, actually, is following a similar trajectory to that, which is that it needs multiple, or basically almost all of the systems in play before the thing's really going to start to kind of, you know, sing internally. And so it's been interesting, and I think this is an interesting discussion that it happens a little bit in game dev, but, you know, writing that line of being disappointed with the thing you're making, but still able to trust in the end vision and keep on working on it. It's definitely I don't know if it's a skill, but I think it helps having other people around to kind of bounce.
I honestly do think that that's just what it is. So I think about game, it's just about having people around who when you're like, fuck this project, that they're like, no, hang in there, buddy.
That's true. I guess that's this. It's happened with everything we've ever made.
Yeah. Well, it's also about the confidence that you have that you'll be able to pull it off, because that important idea that we say a lot, which is that, you know, ideas don't matter. It's only execution.
Right.
But while you're in the middle of executing something, things are bad until they're good. That's just, they don't get to be good first or even be good early on, or, you know, it requires an enormous amount of work to make them good, which means most of the time that you're working on a thing, some creative endeavor, it's going to suck. And you're going to have a tendency to say, well, this is just a bad idea. I should mm-hmm. just start over, take a different approach, maybe take out this system, add a new system, whatever, instead of trusting that you'll be able to execute it and that it's just a matter of getting across the shittiness hump, you know, where mm-hmm. you can actually get to the good
thing. The shittiness hump.
Yep.
Yeah.
Which is, it's more like a mountain, really. Because it just takes a lot. Once you get over it,
then there's another
one. Now you're just downhill skiing.
Well, I was going to say, actually, there's just another one. Turns out it's a mountain range.
It's a range of mountains.
It's just a long slog.
But this is also why you see, you know, so many people who are setting out on creative endeavors, especially by themselves. So if they're writing a book or whatever, there's this really fun idea generation phase where you're like, oh, like we could do all these things. Like, I have this great idea. We're going to have this game, it's like an MMO, but it's also like integrated with Twitch. And then he's got like, it's a first person shooter, but it's also an RTS, you know, and like you come up with all this crazy shit and then you go to work on it and then it's just garbage.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't mean that the idea is bad, although that particular one that I just put out was pretty bad.
Maybe.
But maybe. Unless somebody does a really good job of it. but then it just takes a really long time. And every day you wake up and especially if you're by yourself, you can make the decision to just be like, I'll just work on something else now. Mm-hmm. Like I got other better ideas.
Right.
And so there's this huge group of people, especially in these creative communities, where I like to think of them as like dream chasers, mm-hmm. right? Where like every day there's a new dream for them to go after because it's so much easier to come up with the idea and just kind of like wistfully kind of long for it. Because once you actually start working on the thing, you just have to wake up and just sort of like stare your own disappointing piece of garbage like in the face all day mm-hmm. for months and months and months. Mm-hmm. It can be very emotionally draining, mm-hmm. right?
Yep.
You just have to hang in there.
Yeah, it's all about just truly believing in the process and believing in yourself as you're engaged with the process. Because for me now, it gets kind of annoying mostly for me to not be able to show people what I'm doing.
Right.
But for me internally, like I don't actually have a personal struggle anymore. I used to have a personal struggle during this kind of long, sort of slow development cycle. But now it's mostly just a bummer that I can't show people what I'm doing, which is a thing that I just know. I'm just, as long as other people trust what I'm doing, then that's also fine.
But you know, so now that you're learning front end web development.
Yeah.
Now you can make stand-ins for showing people stuff, right? So you can be like, look, if you click this button, now magic happens behind the scenes, which took me 6 months to do.
Right. The cool stuff is all the behind the scenes magic. And this is true for games too, right? There's a lot of, when you're playing a game, when you experience, you know, some really epic moment, that's just the tip of this enormous iceberg of all the time and attention and care and love that went into that thing to give you that experience.
You don't think about the magic that happens when you're playing Halo and you don't fall through the ground.
Yeah.
Right? Like, which is a hard problem, actually.
Yeah.
There's a lot of stuff that goes into it.
Speaking of which, there's this new series on Gamasutra called Dirty Coding Tricks. Which
so good.
For any of you who are just interested in reading up on essentially the goofy stuff that does go into the behind the scenes of various games and is essentially programmers hacking their way around various various problems, but like usually on a really tight deadline. It's some of the funniest game dev sort of, I guess, behind the scenes work that I've read about. And in particular, I think there's stuff like, the one from yesterday was this idea that there's this company that was putting out this game on the Xbox, and the Xbox didn't have enough memory to hold all of its levels and play it at one time. And so what happened is after you played a level, if you played like two or three in a row, then the Xbox would just crash. And so
they weren't cleaning up the RAM between levels well enough.
And because of the way that they did their dev, they actually didn't figure this out until basically right before they needed to have it submitted for going gold, which is when that actually gets burned onto a physical disc in a factory. And you can't go back from that, especially back then. And so the way they got around this problem was not by, like, they couldn't figure out how to clean up the memory enough. And so they ended up doing this thing where it shows a loading screen. So it looks like it's loading, and then it fades to black. And what actually happens is that they turn off the Xbox because that allows for complete memory wipe. And then using the Xbox's API, tell it to restart itself at the next level in the game.
So it skips the loading screen. It skips the like game selection screen or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So they just reboot the console and reboot it right back into the next level.
And nobody knows. Nope.
Yeah. So the quote loading screen is just your Xbox turning itself off and on again. So
this is the sort of thing where, like, you know, everyone, you're going to focus on these big cinematic moments or, you know, the gameplay or whatever else, but there's thousands of these goofy stories in the background.
Yeah. My favorite story mm-hmm. is from one of these previous Gamma Sutra series about Fallout mm-hmm. where, they needed a train that you could ride, and they realized much later in dev than they should have that they actually didn't have any code to allow things to move in the world.
Just objects.
Right? Objects. Yeah. The only things that could move were characters. And so they solved this problem by creating a character whose head was a train, and it's a person now running along the ground with a train for a head. And they just put a second sort of plane underground that the train person could run on. So their body is underground and their train head is up on the tracks. So when you board a train, you're actually standing inside a man's head and he's like running on the ground underneath the train.
They show a picture of the 3D model for it because it has legs.
Like, yeah, it's a legit human model running around with a train head.
Yeah, very funny.
So this kind of shit happens all the time. And unfortunately, no, like this to me is the stuff that's like the real magic.
Oh yeah. And it's easy to get disappointed when people don't know and can't possibly know about all the things that you did to make mm-hmm. a thing finally work. And to give a person that little tiny experience, just because just the mountain of stuff that I go into that is enormous. And while you're climbing that mountain, you know, looking for the peak that is the only thing that other people are actually finally going to see. And you don't even get to see it because it's so far away from you right mm-hmm. now. You know, it can feel a little bit exhausting, but you just got to trust in that system.
Every day you make the game 0.2% better.
Yep.
You know, that's why eventually it's fine.
That's why we changed our production process, because we're looking at actually the system.
Faster.
Yeah, we're looking at the system. We're like, the system's not going to be good enough for this mm-hmm. in a big way. So we got to make those sort of fundamental changes.
And in a lot of ways, it's actually you guys leaping from mountain to mountain, but staying at the same level every time, right? Because if you're like, let's change all of this now, as you were just like in the middle of climbing the mountain, right? Then what you've really done is just move to another mountain.
Right, which mm-hmm. is still, we're still in sort of like the shitty undergrowth of the mountain.
But what you want to do is climb a whole bunch of small hills first, so you can kind of
figure out what you're doing,
get warmed up, learn all the rules, you know? And then, because the other part of this too, because we started talking about tooling and, you know, trying to put together some scripting and some other things to make it easier to bring things to a production level. And that was actually part of the problem, was that things weren't ready for production because they still need to be prototyping. But because we were trying to push everything towards production, mm-hmm. then that also started to make us think, well, now we need some tooling because we need to make sure we can get all of these characters in here and all of these creatures and stuff. When really we should have said, well, we don't need any of them in there because
we're still developing systems.
We're still prototyping. Right. We don't need that yet. And so we don't need the additional layer of tooling to now get all of them in there as fast as possible, because we should wait until all the rules are actually set in place.
Because you can't develop tools till you know the rules, as they say. I think it's,
Yep.
Also, in the news this week, Sam did a high-intensity interval training.
Oh, my God.
And apparently
God.
There's a story there.
Well, the story is just that, you know, I'm coming into my 28th year of life. And I was like, I feel like I'm in pretty good shape for this. So we get back from Uruguay last week, and on Monday evening, I was like, you know, it worked out a couple of days. So I'm going to go ahead and do this. It's like a 15-minute or it's a 30-minute workout total. And it's like the beginner's HIIT workout. And all a HIIT workout is it's just a series of, in this case, it was no weights. You're just like, I was just in my house, basically doing jumping jacks.
You kind of, it's like the Adventure Time dance where their arms turn into noodles They just kind of like wave around.
So you're just wiggling around. And so I was, you know, I was feeling pretty good about myself. I feel like overall in terms of where I'm at in life. And then I did this HIIT workout. I only lasted for, I think, like 11 minutes of the 30. Literally felt like I was going to vomit. Like, it was like the hardest I've worked out in a long time. And I was like, what is happening? And then now I'm still sore. Like my whole body is still so sore.
Week ago.
That I woke up last night at 4 a.m. hurting. I had to go take some more Tylenol because my legs were just tired. And I was like, what happened to me? I thought I was young and feeling good. And then it just.
Yeah. But the crazy thing is you are still. And it's like, so think about where you're at now. Just extrapolate that another 20 years. Because compared to, you know,
when I turned 28, that's when shit started to go south. So, you know, that's probably.
That's what I got to look forward to.
That's just the magic age.
Yep.
It is. Yeah, I think so. We don't need, we technically don't need to live past that, you know, from an evolutionary perspective.
It's supposed to get all your work done before.
You could have, like, you know, from like a caveman days, you could have been a grandparent by this age.
Yeah.
You know,
could have made a lot of babies.
Yeah. So, you know, you're an elder. You're a village elder now.
That's true.
You're good. You don't need to be doing high intensity workout exercises.
You've got grandkids for that.
Yeah.
have them go hunt wild animals or whatever.
Yeah. Send the babies out.
I'll just become toothless and have them feed me. That's what will happen.
Yeah. That's probably what would have happened back then. And also, speaking of workouts, so we talk a lot about process improvements. Right. And about trying to examine the way that you do things to, you know, get more out of life.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you do all the things that you want to do, then you're already in much better shape than literally almost everybody.
Yep.
Because most people don't do the things they want to do. And then on top of that, if you can do things faster and more efficiently than everybody else, then you just get to have more life.
Mm-hmm.
Right. If you do twice as many things as everybody else, then you basically lived
two times, lived
a double lifetime. Which is awesome.
Not a double life, though. That's different.
You could, like, you have a family, depending on which things you're doing.
That's true.
You know? Actually, true, because
it
if
could
you
be
do,
the way you do that.
If you do things twice as efficiently, you could just have a double life.
You can weave
both of which are like a regular person's normal life.
Yeah, mm-hmm. You can weave a double life sort of in the middle there, right? So you've now got two families and two homes with two mortgages, mm-hmm. you know, and you work two full-time jobs.
With two sets of hobbies.
Yeah, two sets
two of circles
hobbies.
Of friends,
mm-hmm. you know. So you could totally do that if you're efficient enough.
Mm-hmm.
So my big kind of realization this past week was, much like Sam, I was like, I'm not in nearly as good of shape as I would like to be, and also as I used to be. And so I was thinking back on a couple years ago when I was going to the gym 5 days a week, and I was like, why was I able to do that at that point? Because I was just as busy, I had just as many things going on, and I lived farther away from the gym. I lived 15-minute drive from the gym. Now I'm 2 minutes away. So, like, you would think that this would be easier, right? And so I thought through my processes, and I realized that because the gym was 15 minutes away, then I had done a lot more planning around it. So back then, I would have a gym bag, you know, where I would have everything I needed. I'd have my soap. I'd have my clothes. I'd have everything so that when it came time to go to the gym, the only thing I did was grab my bag and go. Go to the gym, work out. Shower at the gym, and then put my normal day, like normal human clothes back on, and then resume normal life. Right. But now, because when we moved and I am now 2 minutes from the gym, my process changed to, well, now that it's time to go, I'll go like wander around the house and find all the things I need, find my lifting gloves, find my shoes, get changed, go out into the cold of winter wearing my gym shorts
or the hot of summer,
go to the gym, work out, come back home. Now I have to decide, when am I going to shower? Do I wait? Do I do it now? Blah, blah, blah.
It's interesting. So this reminds me of the optimal difficulty problem from driving, which is that a lot of studies found that if you're driving on a wide open road, then you have a higher incidence of crashes. Like those roads that you're on that have like the switchbacks.
Yeah.
Where everyone's just gripping the wheel and really, really paying attention, usually have a lower crash rate than the busier.
It's definitely
open.
A higher sort of like rate of heart attacks.
Oh, yeah,
a
for
lower
sure.
rate of just accidents.
Your adrenaline's higher the whole time.
Yeah.
But my bet is that with the preponderance of cell phone usage while driving, that's no longer true.
But I think that's the thing.
Because I think now, no matter what you're doing, people still talk on their phones.
I mean, that's what Dr. Strange is about. You know, he's driving at 300 miles an hour on a windy road. He starts texting somebody, and then he becomes a wizard.
Yep.
Which seems basically like what happened. But yeah, so back, I mean, back to your thing, it's like, you know, you went from having a very actually a difficult time getting to the gym, which required that you sort of essentially paid more attention.
Yeah, I had to commit to the idea of turning this into part of my routine by moving closer to the gym. I thought, oh yeah, now it's just so easy. I don't need to worry about it. Mm. But then I made it so that I had to make repeated decisions leading up to the moment that I stepped out the door, which means every one of those decisions is an inflection point where I could just decide to not, right? So that means that I was going to the gym one or two days a week instead of five. And sometimes I just wouldn't go for a week, right? And so...
Also, it's a good idea to kind of get your gym time in now, because starting on the 1st, for exactly 2 weeks, the gym's going to be real busy.
Yep.
Fortunately...
It only lasts for 2 weeks. It only lasts for 2 weeks.
But yeah, I got to get that time in now.
Well, what I can probably do is... During the first couple weeks of the year, I can go at like six o'clock in the morning or something, because people who do the New Year's resolutions, like, they're not that committed. They're not going to go at six in the morning.
That's true. No, that's true.
They'll try to weave it into their normal, like, after work or something, and then they'll just abandon it. So, So I've repacked my gym bag. I'm back on the train there. But that comes down to that, you know, by batching your processes and trying to figure out, like, where are your decisions happening? And then you automate those processes so that you don't make those decisions, right?
I also think about, like, you're, by forcing yourself to actually shower at the gym, I feel like you're reducing the chance that there's just going to be a weird distraction point that happens, like, when you get home. So for me, if I get home from the gym and I'm super sweaty, but of course, now I'm home. So maybe I, like, make food or just go kind of mess around with the computer a little bit or whatever. So, like, there's this lag window before I'm actually, like, done being at the gym.
Because you're still gross and you're like, I can't, like, I don't want to, like, go out in public. I don't want to, like, go to groceries or do normal human activities because I'm just covered in sort of human disgustingness.
Right. So you kind of reduce the possibility of there being some waste in there.
Yeah, exactly.
I dig it.
So you turn the gym experience into just one whole complete package. Mm-hmm. You go there looking like a normal human. You sweat everywhere. Mm-hmm. You vomit a whole bunch. You shower and clean yourself up. Put your clothes back on. You resume being a normal human, and then you go back to
as
if it never happened.
Yep.
No one will ever know that you worked out. But you just gradually get more and more super jacked.
Yeah,
yeah.
And people are like, I've never seen you in gym clothes. And you're like, I don't know.
It's crazy.
I've never even seen you sweat, people will say. So
you always smell so good.
You always smell so good. All right. So that's my gym story.
I dig it.
All right. So that's all the news we have for this week. Let's get on to some questions. And these questions come from our listeners over at podcast.bscotch.net. Although perhaps in the future, that website will be changing.
It definitely will.
Adam's totally overhauling our web.
What do you think of
that's a little bit lower on the priority list, though, is the podcast page, because it does exist, it works, like, whatever, gets the job done, but it's due for a slap.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm more upset with actually the functionality. Like, I don't think it looks great, but it's passable, you know. But I'm more upset with how the thing actually works behind the scenes, which is stuff that nobody actually knows. Yeah. Mm. So if you think it's ugly, and you're correct, what I'm telling you is that
it's even uglier on the inside.
If it's what's on the inside that counts, then it's real bad.
It's even uglier than you could possibly imagine.
You know, at least it's living its truth, you know?
Yeah,
it is. It's true to itself. It's authentic.
Yep.
Just as hideous
yep.
on the outside as it is on the inside.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Basically the priority list is rebuild www.bscotch.net so I can relaunch it. And then everything that's peripheral to that, like podcast.bscotch.net and forum, like all those things, will then over time slowly get pulled under that umbrella. But it's going to be a bit before that happens.
All right. It's going to be good, though.
It will be.
Also, before we get to questions, one last thing I wanted to talk about, which is the Shenana Jam. Mm.
I guess we have dates on that, don't we?
We have dates on this. Not like the weird fruit, but actual times of the...
Nor actual human dates, like two people
going meeting and to a place. Having coffee.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So the idea is the Shenana Jam is something that we did back in May, and we had 150
people, I think.
It was just a shit ton of people.
We had 120 submissions.
120 games.
And 300 people.
Submitted.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So it is a game jam.
Yeah.
It's a game jam that we host over the interweb. And it turned out to be super fun. We had a Discord server running that everybody just piled into, and mm-hmm. people were sharing their games. And so we were thinking sort of, what can we do with the Shenanigans Jam to really make it into a real thing? And so our solution is we're going to try to rope in as many other game developers as we can. Mm-hmm. And we have our sort of contact management system internally where we keep tabs on everybody in the universe. Mm-hmm. And we were just kind of perusing it after our Uruguay trip, and we realized we've got almost like 600 developers mm-hmm. in this system. So we're going to try to rope in as many people as we can.
Yeah, we're basically going to see how many other full-time professional dev studios we can get to hop on board with this. Mm-hmm. Sort of be
bet is it's going to be a low fraction.
It might be zero.
But it's a big number, though. So it might be zero. But yeah, but even if we get a handful, that'd be pretty.
If 1% of them, yeah. We got six.
Yeah. So, which is really not bad.
Yeah. So, but the idea there would be if we can get commitments from at least some, or even just one mm-hmm. other studio to be like, yeah, we'll have some people in. Then that we can use to kind of help boost the event, where we can say, like, hey, like, come make games alongside, you know, us, and then whoever else, you know, mm-hmm. jumps in. And so we're going to start promoting the thing pretty soon and allowing signups pretty soon. Mm-hmm. And I think the date is going to be the weekend of June 8th.
I think so.
So June 8th, 9th, 10th, it'll be a 3-day game jam. So mark your calendars, and then coming up.
The page is already up, I think, isn't it?
We got to do a quick revision pass on it, okay. But it's about ready. So probably next episode, we'll have some info on where to go for that. So keep your eyes out. All right, let's get on the questions. First question comes from Blonde Viking 91.
The Regal.
Yeah. Just saw Badland Brawl announcement from Finnish Frogmind. Mm. Reminded me a lot of your Jam game and Scuffle Buddies. How do you feel about this? How should one feel about other studios attempt at your own idea in development?
Mm. Well, so this really comes down to the idea of simultaneous invention, which is basically just a problem that you will have if you make anything creatively. And a good way to look at this is to look at the glut of, what is it, sort of class-based FPSs that just suddenly appeared all at once.
And they were all multiple year-long
projects. 2-3-4 year projects.
And those studios didn't call each other 4 years ago and say, hey, you guys want to make an FPS? We're going
to
make one too.
It's basically the same, yeah. And so I think it's a big thing to understand is that someone is making your game somewhere. And the really important thing is that you figure out enough ways to execute it so it's just better than theirs, or to add stuff
or
to
different
it.
Different enough.
So that it's different. And so, yeah, we took a look at Badland Brawl, and it looks rad. It's beautiful, first of all.
Very polished.
Very polished, but the extent of that sort of the extent of the gameplay does mirror to a degree what we did with Snuppy Rustlin' and what exists in Scuffle Buddies, but with a lot of tremendous differences that I think we're going to be totally fine not being compared to them. Even if people say, oh yeah, the combat is reminiscent of blah.
I think even just based on the stuff that the public does know about Snuppy Rustlin' and Scuffle Buddies. Mm-hmm. Badland Brawl is basically a physics-based, PvP-based
right.
action game that in its format is a lot like what we have, where you got like, you know, a one-dimensional field or two-dimensional field in the middle that's like a line that your character's running across. Mm-hmm. Then you've got things on the side, and you're like playing cards basically to try to like keep enemies from getting to your base basically. Mm-hmm. But theirs is in real time and it's action-based. And ours is strategy based,
right.
So it's different. It's mm-hmm. going to be different in feel, and then we also have a lot of other stuff that kind of wraps around that that no other game is going to have.
Yeah, and this is actually an important point though, because similar to when we, you know, a year into Crashlands, we talked about this inflection point where we realized that the game didn't have a differentiation factor at all, and that's where we put the story in. It's interesting looking at Badland Brawl, because we talked about when we initially finished Snuppy Rustling for the Shenanigans Jam last year, we were like, we could just polish this up. We could literally polish this up and publish it as a multiplayer PvP thing within like a month.
We could have just this core game concept done and published in 4 months. Mm-hmm.
But then we were looking around, we're like, everybody's making this thing right now, which is these either like a card-based game or a sort of just PvP-oriented thing. And we said, okay, so if that's the case, is there something else we can do here? Is there some other interesting twist that would allow us to put this game not against all those people, but into its own genre category? And so that's actually where the buddies aspect of the Scuffle Buddies game comes into play. So I can't say any more about it than that, but there's a lot more going on than what you see in a game like Battle of the Brawl or, you know, Clash Royale or any of these other games.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And by the time we launch Scuffle Buddies, it'll be, you know, 2030.
Basically.
So people will have forgotten about Battle and Brawl anyways. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But I mean, it's guaranteed there's going to be more of these coming out. Like, it's just guaranteed. Mm-hmm. So we've already seen it with, I mean, Clash Royale is essentially the same thing, but from the top
down with multiple lanes.
Yeah. This one's one lane from the side. And so it's, you know, there's going to be more of them. So it's always about having really good execution. And we talked about this in our talk in Uruguay about, again, honing your production processes and being fast, because the goal is actually to be out before the other people so that they get compared to you as opposed to the other way around. Right. And so that you can absorb the market before they do.
Exactly. Yep. Yeah. And this simultaneous invention idea, I've always found pretty fascinating, because it was weird to me when I was young that all of a sudden one year there's Ants and A Bug's Life. Both came out at the same time, both from two completely distinct studios. And like, we're making CGI games or movies about bugs.
Yep. And I feel like Deep Impact and Armageddon came out at the same time.
Same year. They were within like a couple months of each other. Mm-hmm. Both studios are like, we're making a movie about asteroids hitting the Earth.
Yep.
And that happened, right? And there's like a couple volcano movies that came out in the same year, like Dante's Peak and like Inferno or something like that. And then I think there was like the 2012 movie. There was some other thing that came, like, this happens just constantly. And I think there's a book called What Technology Wants, which is kind of obsessed with this idea. Mm-hmm. Basically that innovation like this happens simply because the conditions of the technological environment or the conditions of the cultural environment are such that they sort of naturally bring about ideas. Mm-hmm. And somewhere somebody is just going to be receptive to that, and they're going to be like, oh yeah, this is great. Like they will have had a eureka moment, you know, where they've thought of something completely new because the conditions around them were right to prompt that idea. Mm-hmm. But that means that somebody else
probably did
is
too.
Probably exposed to similar conditions. Right.
And actually probably a lot of people, but
yeah.
then you get that subset, that random subset of people who have come up with that idea at the same time and are also capable of executing it.
Right.
And so that's why you don't see 10 Armageddon movies in one summer.
Right. Not everybody can make a blockbuster scale movie.
Almost right. Nobody can, right? It's the same deal with making a viable game that could go out in the market. Mm-hmm. There's almost nobody who can actually do that from a statistical perspective. So while there are probably a lot of people making the same kind of thing that you are making.
How many of them can execute?
It's going to be not very many. So now it's just a dice roll about you getting out before that one or two other people actually get out with the same thing.
Yeah, it's a fascinating concept. It's weird because once you are aware of it, you can't help but see this just everywhere.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right, next question comes from Woland77. You seem to be very agnostic to trends in the gaming industry. To what extent is playing games important to making games?
Well, since games take, again, as we said, like somewhere between usually a year to 3 years to make and get out there, any games you're playing are essentially
the trends were 4 years in the
making.
The trend is actually 4 years behind what you see.
Right. And so part of the interesting thing actually about being on the dev side and interacting with so many other devs is actually getting to see the other side of it. So getting to talk to people. And like I said, we have about 600 people now in our dev list and in our contact system. And those are people we've all talked to about what they're making. And so it's interesting because you can see maybe what's actually coming in, you know, 2 or 3 years, because we know all these people who are actively making new games. As far as the actual play goes, I think the most important part of playing new games is oftentimes just to have those potential moments where you see how you could comparatively take a system from a currently existing game or a way that they do a particular thing and just apply it to your own. And there's that line for art, which is that great artists steal. I think it's the same thing with game dev. You go play a game and you're like, oh wow, this game has an infinite inventory system. It manages itself. I'll take that.
Yeah. We met this dude down in Uruguay who's a solo developer. He's making a game called Forager, which is available on Itch. Super friendly guy. He's just making this game on his own, but it's a crafting based kind of a game. Mm-hmm. And when we sat down to chat with him, and he's like, listen, I am stealing like almost everything that you guys have done in Crash. Yeah. We're like, that's fine.
But it's really fun for us because that gets that feeling of pushing the genre forward, right? Because that's what what you do. Mm-hmm. The reason why you have a genre is to rely on these various design heuristics to sort of get you started and get going.
Once somebody breaks the rules and shows that it's totally fine,
right,
or even better, then you can be like, oh, well, mm-hmm. I'm going to take that.
Because I think it's a big part of it is looking around. We had one of these where we were looking at sort of kicking up some of the juice in our games. And I think Seth saw a game that just rotated the camera when the screen shook. Instead of just shaking it left and right and up and down, it actually mm-hmm. tilted it, which, again, shouldn't be a breakthrough. Yeah. But we were like, oh, we can do that.
Yeah, we can. Yeah, let's just do that.
And it adds a nice little, you know, punch to everything.
Yeah, because our original camera shake was just more like camera vibration.
Right, yeah.
Like the camera would just literally just vibrate. So now we have two types of camera shake where we can actually shake it, where it's almost like it's kind of rocking back and forth. And then we also have the vibration now. So now we have multiple tools in our kit.
Yeah, so I think it's
that going to go back into Crashlands some updates so we get some fancier
screen
shake?
I think so.
It'd be nice.
You got to deploy it carefully, because also now with these weird long phones with a 2x1 aspect ratio, when you rotate the screen only 1 degree,
it feels
like you're gonna throw up. So you gotta like really,
it's 1 degree, but then you have to go 2,000 pixels away right. to see the effect of that.
Yeah, which is amplified pretty dramatically.
Yeah. So, but I think that's the whole purpose of playing new games is actually just to see what everybody else is doing and you know, find new effects that you like and on the art side, find stuff that gets you inspired. And then also, ideally, to be surprised. But I'm going to be honest, like, it doesn't happen that much. So one of the games I found most surprising, I've talked about before, was the Hands of Fate game, which the sequel just came out recently. Because I'd just never seen a game that operated the way that one does, where it was this weird combination of dice rolling, cards, and then
like
third-person combat that was really punchy. And it was just really neat. And the whole thing just, like, it captivated me for, like, 3 days. And that doesn't happen too much, truthfully.
Most games just feel...
They're kind of the same.
They just feel the same.
But I think that's the thing to keep your eye out on and just kind of give you regular inspiration points, but then always take notes. Like, I think that's the funny thing about it. One of my friends came over and, you know, he asked what I've been doing all day. And I was like, oh, I've been converting this book I read into a bunch of notes and then I'm putting these into our marketing template. And he's like, so you're telling me you basically do book reports for fun? And I was like, yeah. And it's the same thing I do with games. We're playing a game. I'm like, oh, that's interesting. You know, it's weird that they did this particular thing and you just write it down and then we'll have a discussion about it in house later. And I think it's a big point. Like if you're just playing them, but you're not paying attention, then who cares? Maybe we'll do something else.
Yeah. But on the developer side, you can't follow the trend because if you do, it takes
you're too late.
It'll take you, you know, 1 to 3 years to implement some trend that you've seen. And by then nobody wants that anymore.
Mm-hmm. I mean, So think about, so World of Warcraft nailed it. And then for the next 8 years, we've got just MMO after MMO being like, this is going to be the one that unseats WoW. And it's like, no, because people are already playing WoW. So
they're good.
They're busy. They're too busy to even know that your game exists, you know? And I mean, this is PUBG. Mm-hmm. So now that it's, what is it, like 6 months out or something like that? I mean, we're already seeing the cusp of like the dawn of the
Clone Wars.
The Clone Wars of... Mm-hmm. Of battle royale style games.
Now, this is going to be a little bit bloodier of a fight because of how pre-publication quality PUBG was. Because
PUBG is going to lose this fight.
It's going to lose actually
unless they do something amazing.
Yeah, because it came out too early. It was half baked when it came out, right?
Yep.
Which makes me wonder too. Had they held on to that game in dev longer, because the remarkable thing is that they really were kind of the first to that. They had to solve a huge number of problems basically while people were playing the game that now they've also solved for other people, right? Hence the big fight between them and Epic, right? But had they not had this success, would Epic have converted
Fortnite
into that game? They actually would have launched. They like that would have been off the table now probably. And so now their biggest competitor wouldn't even be there. They'd have a highly polished game so that not only did they have a game people love, but also
they can lock out.
Look like shit.
Yeah. Well, and also Fortnite launched pretty recently before PUBG, and it just wasn't doing well.
Yep.
I think it was after PUBG, I think.
Was it?
Yeah.
And it was just pretty close.
Yeah.
But either way, it was a matter of Epic has this highly polished game that relies on the same third person kinds of mechanics. Very easy to convert it to PUBG.
And they hadn't written it off yet. And then they saw the sort of thing that they could do because. Mm-hmm. Because PUBG was such a rising hit at that time, you know?
Yeah, but, I remember playing PUBG and being impressed at the concept, but very unimpressed at the general execution. Like, I was riding in a motorcycle with somebody, and I could see my character, like, stuttering around, you know, like, bouncing around and stuff. Like, suddenly I get shot, like, I don't know where it's coming from. I got like, it's just very kind of all these rough edges where I couldn't right. feel like I could really enjoy the game. But, you know, if you watch people playing Fortnite, you know, it's, real polished. It's beautiful,
right.
you know, and it looks smooth as butter. And so it's that kind of edge that, you know, makes me think, well, this is actually an interesting problem that you don't see very often is somebody making a game that goes into early access that's really unpolished, but such a good concept that they actually lose it out. To their own clones. And actually, I mean, Threes kind of had this problem.
It's hard to lose. Yeah, actually, that's exactly right. Yeah.
So Threes they launched it's a real simple puzzle game. We all know it as 2048 because they launched it as a real simple puzzle game. It took them like a year to make it, and it was a couple bucks. The game concept is simple enough that I know like internally we were able to make a game like that in a matter of hours, which means anybody else, like now that, like you said, now that they've solved all the hard problems of making a puzzle game like this.
Yeah. They've solved all of it and they made it simple. So now everybody else just has a solution.
Yeah. Anybody can look at it and go, yeah, I'll just do that. And so then 2048 was just a clone of Threes, but it was free.
Yep.
And
it looked better.
Yeah. So sort of like what you got going on with Fortnite, right? It's free and it looks better.
Well, I think the other thing with the idea of keeping up with industry trends is that the unfortunate fact that games just take a fuckload of time to make.
Yeah.
There's no way, you know, if your game takes 2 years to make and then you realize that maybe you're on the wrong side of the trend.
What you can do?
Well, yeah. What are you going to do about it?
You just got to ignore the trends.
You probably just need to ignore it and see if you can knock it out and then again pivot the game slightly to get on a different side of whatever
goal is to predict trends so that you're kind of at the cusp of the wave, then you fall prey to the same thing that every predictor does, which is that you're going to be wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And
we've seen this with VR already. I mean, there's been a bunch of studios who certainly have not found success in VR yet.
No.
Yeah. When we did our panel in Uruguay, we just asked a room full of people, like how many of you are making VR games? And it's like half.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so,
and when we were at Steam Dev Days last year,
way more than half.
It was easily 3/4 of the audience.
So I think the reason that we're agnostic toward these things is we realize we can't predict them. We can't predict trends. And also we can't
take advantage of trends.
We can't take advantage of them. And so our focus should just be on making just really, really good shit that's in our wheelhouse that we know how to do.
And then just kind of watch what's happening so that we can adapt if we have to.
Yeah.
And I will say one of our rules kind of going forward here is that we do try to actually look at the market in a very realistic sense and say what might be missing right now that we could possibly fill the gap with. And then
knowing that by the time we actually release a hundred things might have filled that
somebody
gap.
Else is already looking at it.
Right. So we still have to differentiate the thing that we're making enough. It can't just be like, ooh, there's a gap here. Let's go fill that gap. Let's fill that gap and then add all this other stuff that is also really interesting and good that people are really into so that it's not just a matter of plugging a hole. It's a matter of identifying a thing that really truly is missing while also shoring up the whole product so that it can't suffer from a simultaneous invention problem.
Well, we actually experienced this with the first professional game we ever worked on.
Yeah.
Which was a game called One Epic Night. Mm-hmm. This wasn't as part of Butterscotch Shenanigans. This was at a studio we worked at before Butterscotch Shenanigans. And it's this was the dawn of the Endless Runner sort of genre explosion because Temple Run came out as a paid game and did badly actually. And then they made it free and laced it with in-app purchases. And all of a sudden it just took off.
Mm-hmm.
And once other studios started seeing the sort of income potential and just how interested people were in this kind of a game, then everybody started rushing to get their own 3D Endless Runners out. And so the studio that we were in at the time, jumped onto this and we just took too long.
Mm-hmm.
Like we took way too long to make this game. And I think,
it was the month right before we were going to release, I think six different
endless,
highly polished Endless Runners came out.
And so by the time we launched it, actually the reviews were, this is easily the best Endless Runner we've played, but
it's just another
Endless Runner.
It was brutal.
Three out of five. Yeah. Almost every review was the same. It was like 2 out of 5 or 3 out of 5, not because of the game, but because
they were tired.
It was too late.
Yeah.
Everybody was tired of it.
Yep.
And so it did. And actually one of the big points of the game was to try to create an Endless Runner that had a lot of extra interesting mechanics to it.
Mm-hmm.
So you weren't just running. You also had, you were a knight and like you had a shield and you could like stab enemies that you ran past and like use your shield to break stuff. And like, you had potions and trinkets and you could equip stuff. And it actually had all these cool systems in it.
Mm-hmm.
But none of that mattered because it was just another endless runner by the time it came out.
Which is also, it's kind of, I remember hearing pretty frequently advice given to upcoming devs. Well, actually, even outside of games and in other industries as well, that when you're trying to figure out what to do, you know, what to make or what to write or whatever, to take a thing that you like and find a way to make that thing better, right? Which is terrible advice. Mm-hmm. Because the only way that can happen is if there's already a backlog of that thing. That thing already exists.
That's why you like it.
And that's why you like it. And you're going to go make incremental progress. And nobody cares about incremental progress. Mm-hmm. Like, people may agree, yeah, this is better.
People care about
new. But I'm going to keep playing WoW.
But I'm going to keep playing WoW.
Yeah, people care about new, not improved.
Right.
So, unless it's an iPhone. Mm-hmm. In which case, people are like, fuck yeah, it's very slightly larger.
Yep.
All right. Next question comes from Ryan Dolph. Why does Patreon feel so icky? People pay other people directly for doing something awesome. It's a no-brainer. But as a consumer, it's just so darn hard to pony up the cash, even for people who have the budget.
Mm. Well, first of all, I just want to say the Patreon logo makes me so angry I could spit.
Their new logo is a stick and a ball.
I don't know what it means.
Oh, they have a new logo? I didn't even know
They redid it, and they announced the rebrand like a couple months ago, and I was like, why?
Why on earth? I have to Google it while we're talking.
Why you do this, Patreon?
It's literally a stick and a circle. Yeah, I'm not sure what it's supposed to mean. Who knows?
Maybe they're opening up a new stickball division.
Yeah, maybe. Anyway, so got that off my chest. So Patreon's interesting. I want it to be, it's supposed to be a good stopgap, right? Where it's like the problem with the internet is essentially that all the ad money's dried up. And it should be the case that you as a person who consumes content feel some responsibility for keeping the person alive whose content you consume.
This is, this is sort of like the...
Yeah, that's the logo.
That's the logo?
Adam just found it.
What in God's name?
It's a blue stick with an orange circle next to it.
Oh my God, they probably paid a lot of money for that. Terrible garbage logo.
Yeah, they could have paid us a lot of money. We could have given them a terrible garbage logo for...
Would take me less time.
Much cheaper.
It kind of comes down to this question of what the internet is for and what the internet does, I think. And this is...
The internet is free to play.
That's basically what it is.
Which is the problem.
And
that's why the internet is a pile of garbage.
Well, I think the reason why Patreon, so we've discussed internally about doing it, but the problem is that we're already making all of the stuff, and actually running a Patreon means we have to make more stuff. Yeah. We have to do more to get people to pay us for the stuff that they're already consuming.
That they're already paying us for.
That they're already paying us for, or should be paying us for in some context.
Yep.
And I think that's the should is basically the problem, where ad revenue on the internet's really been drying up. And as a result, you have this huge swath of people who create stuff and much bigger swath of people who consume all of it, but who don't give a fuck about keeping the people alive make it.
It's the free rider problem.
Yeah.
Right.
And so as a result, then, you know, you'll have stuff. I mean, if you look at even Touch Arcade, Touch Arcade has their own Patreon, and it's actually now like kind of the backbone of their ability to be alive, because the ad revenue has just like disappeared the last couple of years. Right. And yeah, I mean, they have a huge reader base, but then you look at that and it's like the total number of people on there is like maybe 1,000 or something every month.
In their Patreon?
Yeah.
It's pretty low.
But, and they're like one
compared,
of the bigger.
Compared to their reader base, it's basically nobody.
But they're one of the bigger ones.
Yeah. And their reader base is full of people who are just avid supporters of Touch Arcade. And it's one of the main places they go to get news and also just to socialize with people they've met that all have the similar interests. And there's just no reason in the universe why they shouldn't be supporting that thing.
Right.
And yet they aren't.
But I think, that leads to the real question, which is, why does it feel weird to support something on Patreon?
To me, it's not a sense of feeling weird, though I imagine that could be an additional thing that happens. But it's actually just the nature of the free-to-play nature of the internet, which is that you don't pay for stuff on the internet. Mm-hmm. You just go look at things, and like everything is expected to be free. And if it's not, that's offensive in some way, right? And so any barrier at all that goes up in front of you, you have an endless sea of content around you that you can go find an alternative to. There's almost nothing on Patreon that you can't find a free alternative to.
Yeah, well, I think that's the real problem is so let's say, God forbid, Touch Arcade collapses because they can't get the Patreon support and the ad revenue continually goes down, which it is doing, but they just aren't able to pay their bills. They shut down. That doesn't mean that there's no mobile news out there. It just means there's going to be a lot of lower quality news spread out across a larger number of sites, right? It's still out there. It's just garbage and hard to find, right? Mm-hmm. So like you're saying, there's endless free alternatives. They may not be the same, quality.
Quality, not by any stretch.
Yeah, and so...
What's the whole joke? Like, you get what you pay for.
Yeah.
Right.
And most people pays for anything on the internet. Yeah.
So that's what they get.
Which gets garbage. But I think it's an unsettling fact. And, you know, of course, all of us do it too, because it's the internet. It's what people do. But that so much of the way we consume media now does not in any way reflect assisting the person who gave us that media in the first place. Whether it's someone who writes reviews or, you know, helps you make a decision about a purchase, or just like entertaining content that you read.
Yeah. But there's also this problem of, I think about things like if you ever try to read a news article on your phone, mm-hmm. you ever try to do this, like go to a legitimate,
you mean
news
read a series of pop-up ads.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
They just lace ads. They weave them into the article. Like every paragraph you're scrolling past things. Sometimes there's those ads that don't let you scroll. Mm-hmm. Until you get to it, and then it's like you're stuck there for a while. Mm-hmm. Some ads pop up and they just start playing, just like sounds. They're just blasting shit mm-hmm. out there. And so because the ad economy, it's an attention economy, and whichever ad gets your attention, that's the one that wins, right? So there's an arms race for which ad can be the most in your face and the most obnoxious. And that's where the site's money comes from. Mm-hmm. So a site that's like a journalism site or whatever, there's this constant push and pull between delivering quality, immersive, contiguous content and making money, right? So they have to show you those ads. People don't like that, so they make ad blockers, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And so people use ad blockers, which then throttles down the ad revenue, which means then the remaining ads or the remaining sort of people who are being shown ads who don't use ad blockers, they get even more obnoxious ads thrown in their face mm-hmm. to try to counteract the fact that half the people are no longer seeing ads. And so you have this, there's just no possible future in which this is there's a win.
Yeah. It's right? it's not going to pan out. Yeah. It's not panning out well. I mean, it's already been the case. You've seen these calls for support from their audience, from basically every major publication. A lot of them have moved to try to figure out some other subscription models or put in just straight up blockers.
Paywalls.
Like various paywalls that do get around the ad block.
Yeah, problems. And really, so. I mean, all of this is easily solved by loot boxes. I mean, if you just, you go there.
Get a random article.
Yeah, you go mm-hmm. there, you pay $5 to get a bunch of keys, and then you get your daily article box mm-hmm. and you open it up, and then sometimes you get a legendary article
and then you
that's
can trade
really
those,
well written.
Trade those mm-hmm. with other players for cash.
Yeah.
You know?
So you can trade your articles. Maybe you get just like, oh, it's just like a common shitty article that's just like a slideshow. You're like, mm-hmm. oh, fuck, you know. But then sometimes you get the legendary article that's like a really well written sort of investigative mm-hmm. reporting piece.
But most of the time it's just a shitty BuzzFeed article.
Yeah.
So very entertaining though. Yeah, no. So I guess the thing that's weird about Patreon is just the fact that it has to exist, I think, is to me a little uncomfortable, because the gap that it's filling is literally the survival gap for creators on
the thing that makes me uncomfortable about Patreon is not the service itself, it's actually going there. Like, if you go to Patreon and try to find things, really what you find is just like a huge number of people just trying. Like yeah. trying so fucking hard, and like they've got mm-hmm. like 1,000 videos up, and they've got like one supporter, you know, giving them like $1 a month, and mm-hmm. you just, it's like it's heartbreaking, you know, because yeah. like there's so many people out there mm-hmm. trying to make stuff, and there's just too much stuff, you know.
Well, I think that's actually the summary of the problem across the board is that the internet did something amazing, which was made it so that everybody was now equal, because all you need is access to a server somewhere and enough money to afford a domain name or to rent a fraction of one from somebody, right? Mm-hmm. And now all of a sudden, and actually most of those just do that for free, right? It's because it's been free to players since the beginning. So now there's just free access to allowing you to put up content that other people can see. So now everything is equal. So now if you go, like you look at BuzzFeed, which, they make a lot of money doing their thing, but they make garbage. Mm-hmm. There's just no way around that fact, right? They make absolute garbage that they probably have some good stuff in there here and there. Mm-hmm. Versus say like The Atlantic, which makes it's like top notch journalism right. that is almost completely dead and doesn't exist anymore. Mm-hmm. Right. And you can read those, like you just click two links side by side and right. now those two things pop up. And so even though we were talking earlier about how there's a free alternative to everything and it's going to be worse probably, but the fact that they're just together means that all of the good stuff is brought down to the level of the bad stuff, which I think is the same problem with the free to play market in games, which is that, yeah, like all of the free stuff, on average, the free stuff is way worse than the stuff that isn't free, right? but there's so much free stuff that it feels offensive that there's stuff you have to pay for.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Yeah. Anytime I see a paywall, like if I go to an article or something and it's like, ooh, sorry, you can't see this because you got to be a subscriber. My usual response is, well, I guess I'm not reading that.
Yeah. Yep. Right. Exactly.
Well, that sucks.
Yep, right.
Because you know? Again, it's, I think the part of the problem too is that you can't know the value of having read a thing until after you've read it.
Right.
So, like, mm-hmm. what's the selling point there? Yep. How do you decide whether to pay for an article?
But that's not true with, like, buying a fucking newspaper. You right. just buy a newspaper, then you go read it.
Because like, I'm sure it's a physical sure object. There's something. Well, not only that, but, like, you're not buying an article. You're buying, yeah. like...
the paper.
Oh, yeah. Whole shit.
Right. Well, you've come to believe in that paper for some reason, so right. you do it. But I think also the pricing models for stuff hasn't caught up with how mm-hmm. people understand the world now because of free-to-play. Because everything is free to play. And so that means that you have to, that microtransactions are the only way for things to work mm-hmm. or really low or, you know, low dollar subscriptions and things. Because there's actually been a few times, like I read literally like one Atlantic article a month, probably usually when somebody sends it to me, cause they're mm-hmm. like, hey, this is really good. And you should read it. So I actually consume almost none of that content, but it's really good. So I'd be happy to pay them for it. Right. Except that if I want to, I think I have to pay like $200 a year or something completely batshit mm. crazy mm-hmm. to read.
So that's
like,
not great.
Yeah. But that's my option. Right. Cause there's no like credit system where I can be like, yeah, I can't pay for the kind of amount right. of content.
So really these companies, if they could somehow enact sort of the Netflix model mm-hmm. where like, oh, $5-$10 a month, maybe, well, fuck yeah. Right. But like in ye olden days, like 8 years ago, when if you wanted to get, say, a subscription to like Wall Street Journal or something like that,
yep.
it's a paper thing that gets delivered to your house and it's fucking huge.
Yeah, there are only like, some people who can deliver that content yeah. to you that's good enough.
And it's hundreds of dollars a year, you yep. know, because they're printing it and handing it to you. Like yep. somebody's coming to your house and handing it to you. That you don't need that anymore. So, and it's digitally distributed. So like, just bring the prices down.
Yeah. Well, and all know? And there were people making little tiny magazines and newspapers and mm-hmm. stuff too, but they couldn't afford to like bring that shit to your door. Right.
Right.
And so there was no comparison between the two. Like if you wanted to get local stuff, you would have to go like to the zine,
right.
Place, you know, brick and mortar place where they have their pile of things out in the front mm-hmm. or whatever, and go find that thing that you curated for yourself. Cause if you were into it for some reason. But that was the only way. There was no just common pool where everything lives.
Well, there's been a few attempts to remedy this. I know they've always been a very high interest from general sort of in the startup industry has been curious about this problem of monetization on the web for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And there's been things like, I think there was one it was called like Pi or something. Do you remember this? Where you basically put in a certain amount of money a month. And then like when you read an article or something like that, then it would like chunk out. Like a piece of your pie, right?
Right.
Or you could like freely give it to people else, which is a cool idea. The problem is, of course, again, if the whole internet doesn't run like that.
Not only that, but that feels bad because then you're like, oh, I read a shitty article, but I still had to pay for it.
Yeah.
right.
There's a tipping one too that operates on a similar principle.
Oh.
The problem is like, because again, all of it's voluntary. So you're just sort of
yeah.
like.
Well, so I was actually talking to Shure about this morning because we were talking about the general trend of. Like where Steam is going, which mm-hmm. is so if you think about what has happened with video, somehow video on the internet has managed to solve this problem and nobody else has, mm-hmm. which is you've got YouTube, which is largely full of garbage, but there's still stuff on there that is good, right? And anybody can put anything on there. Mm-hmm. So in effect, YouTube is like the mobile stores.
Sure.
Right? Huge glut of content. Almost universally free.
Most of the good stuff is stolen.
So who knows like whether you can find something good, but then they use all kinds of algorithms to push you toward the content you want, mm-hmm. right? And then you've got Netflix, which is doing incredibly well. Like they don't have a Patreon, mm-hmm. right? Like they're doing business and they have a subscription service. They deliver highly curated quality content that also sort of recycles out. So you can be pretty much rest assured that most of the things that you find on Netflix are actually at least decent,
yeah.
mm-hmm. right? And so people are willing to pay for that service. And it's not like everyone they watch, it like chunks out a credit. You know, it's right. like you just pay your monthly fee and now, boom, you've got it and you can just do whatever you want.
Mm-hmm. And those things are accessible in other places too, but everywhere you would go to get those things, you're going to have to pay for it in some way.
Right. Right. So if you want to buy a DVD, mm-hmm. that's like $20.
Or if you want to go to Amazon instead, then either you need to be in Prime or you need to pay for a rental or whatever. So, right. So the idea is that you can't, that content just isn't free. Mm-hmm. That's paid content.
Right.
And you can pay into subscription services that pool, because the problem here, like the reason that this doesn't work on the internet to have paid content is because we all visit like 100 fucking websites,
yep.
right? And we get our news from all kinds of places. We follow people's links, you know, from all the things that they're sharing with us. And so we need the same thing. We need a curated single location that manages paying money to right. people who are creating content. Because it's the only practical way, because people aren't willing, even if they like a dozen different websites and visit them regularly,
them, yeah.
you're not going to go pay $100 a year for each for a dozen different websites, you know?
Yeah.
It's got to be curated in some way.
But this does kind of beg the question of, with Steam Direct, we've now reached a point where there isn't actually there used to be a solution in the games that was kind of like Netflix, in the sense that like there's a curated place with actually mm-hmm. a pretty low volume of content compared to, you know, the rest mm-hmm. of the internet, but where you could pretty much rest assured that, yeah, whatever I buy, you know, it's pretty much good. And that's no longer true, where we're now Google Play, the App Store, Steam, you know, Itch, like any place you go to get games now is a lot more like YouTube. Mm-hmm. And it's getting more and more like that, where anybody can just put anything.
But I think that's where a lot of subscription services are popping up. So you got like the Humble Monthly, actually probably is the best example of that, where you pay, it's like $12 a month, and then you just get a bunch of rad games every mm-hmm. month.
Right. Right. But I think it's different in this, isn't it, like?
It is curated.
It's curated, but it's also if you subscribe, you don't get retroactive access to stuff, right?
Correct.
It's new stuff, yeah. So the incentive to subscribe doesn't go up over time.
Right.
If you just miss something, like, well, shit, I guess you missed it.
right.
So this is all really, it's difficult.
Yeah, but it is probably going to, I think just everything that people are going to have to pay for is going to have to move towards bundled subscription kinds mm-hmm. of models, because I think that's going to be true for games.
And this will fortunately get us out of the loot box problem. It'll get us, you know, if you just subscribe and you play the games. And this is, I know Hatch, Robio's mm-hmm. Hatch, is doing this, and we've got Crashlands in there as part of their sort of pioneer beta program. It's mm-hmm. subscription service for games. You just subscribe.
That's it.
You fire it up on your Android device. You play the shit out of it. Do mm-hmm. whatever you want, right?
Yep. Amazon did this, but they did it in the grossest way possible with Amazon Underground.
As per usual.
Yep. Which then collapsed, I'm pretty sure, by now.
Yep.
Yeah, so that...
Last year.
Because their business model was nobody puts any money in the system, mm-hmm. and somehow developers get paid a tiny, tiny, tiny amount of money.
But not very much, because nobody put money in.
Yeah.
So
it was,
didn't work out.
Actually, yeah, that was right. It was completely free. It wasn't free to play. It was a completely free subscription model. You subscribe to it without paying anything.
Mm-hmm. They show you ads.
And then did they show you ads?
Yeah.
No.
So there you go.
There you go.
Okay. There it is. So, all right. Yeah. So who knows where the hell this is going?
We'll find out.
Down, I guess, is the general, general trajectory. Mm-hmm. So we'll see. All right. So that's all the time we have for this week. Thank you all for listening. We'd like to thank our studio wrangler, Monique, and our producer, Fat Bard, for putting this episode together, and the Beescotch dev team for having our backs while we record this podcast. Special thanks to our community moderators who keep our Discord and forums running. And if you'd like to get more involved in the Beescotch community, you can hop into our Discord server, which is at discord.gg/Beescotch. Come say hey. We also have a section in there that's just for game dev, and lots of people are still working on their Shenanigam games from back in May. So we'll probably be sort of beefing up that section of the Discord as we ramp up for the Shenana Jam going forward. So, hop on in there, come say hey. Also, if you'd like to adorn your body with Butterscotch merch, you can check out our shop, which is at shop.bscotch.net. Or if you'd like to send us your swag, we have a mailbox, so you can head on over to mailbox.bscotch.net, and all the info is there. So thank you all for listening, and we'll see you next week.
Goodbye.
Bye.